Good morning. We're reading this morning from Matthew 9, verses 14 and 17. Then the disciples of John came to him, saying, "Why do we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them,
"The wedding guests cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them. Can they? The day will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and they will fast. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old cloak, for the patch pulls away from the cloak, and a worse tear is made. Neither is new wine put into old wineskins. Otherwise the skins burst, and the wine is spilled, and the skins are destroyed. But new wine is put into fresh wineskins, and so both are preserved."
Would you pray with me? Holy God, bless those ancient words. Help them to bump around our hearts and our minds, to bring us new understanding of how we can be faithful people in the world today, which seems to be changing so rapidly. Help us to be of good courage with humility. In the name and in the spirit of Jesus, we pray and we say together, Amen. So the sermon series that I'm working on is called Earth Honoring Faith, and today we'll be focusing on the world that we have. And the primary source is this book by Larry Rasmussen called Earth Honoring Faith, Religious Ethics in a New Key, for those of you who enjoy mixing metaphors of music and song. It's also, we're using some of the foundational principles of creation spirituality. Matthew Fox was really the most contemporary person to lift up the concept of original blessing, and St. Francis of Assisi knew about it many, many, many years ago, so it's not something new, but it does encourage us to see ourselves as integrally related to the world around us, as opposed to even our foundational story in Genesis, which for many, many years was interpreted as, and the humans were the crown jewel of creation and therefore have dominion over everything. That's a fairly humanist-centered perspective on the world, is it not? Yes, we are endowed with some incredible gifts, unlike other animals. And we all know how good we are at self-deceit. Can I get a witness on that? Science informs and religion motivates. It's sort of one of the heart and soul of this piece. And it kind of gets at the reality that we can be a source of healing for the world, and we can also be a source of challenging, or one might even say destroying, the balance of the globe of Earth. I happen to believe that there is an ecological crisis. Now, I can give you a part of the reason is that I was an environmental studies major in college, so I've always had this tree hugger character about me. So you're just going to have to realize that's the place from which I come. I tend to be more on the side of the environment and knowing that we need our place in it, and recognizing that resources of this earth are limited. And we have done a really good job of reproducing this human race. So I want to start with a story that has been so central to the life of the Christian faith that many of us know it as the Good Samaritan story. And I'll give you a very quick synopsis. There was a guy who got beat up and robbed and left beside the road, and one religious guy came by and couldn't stop And another very religious person walked by and didn't stop. And a third person walked by who was from a different world altogether, a complete foreigner. In fact, someone who would be perceived as an enemy, perhaps in our 21st century perspective, a Muslim, stopped and helped the person beside the road. Now, Jesus told this parable, you'll remember, because one of the lawyers who was grilling him said, "How is it that I love my neighbor, or who is my neighbor?" And so this story makes clear when Jesus says, "Well, who do you suppose was the neighbor?" And the lawyer responds, "Well, I suppose the one that showed him mercy." The most unexpected character of the story. I wonder if part of this earth-honoring faith is for us to begin to see the earth as our neighbor. And are we called to show mercy to our neighbor, the earth? Now, before I talk about how we might go about doing that, I just want to call out how it is that we often see the world. And my guess is that one of the ways we see the world is to live at polar extremes and tend to see there's this and there's that, there's this and there's that. Because we're human beings are terrific at sorting and classifying. Ever notice that? It's also our Achilles heel. So if you're looking at this picture, which do you see first, the cat or the dog? How many of you are cat people? How many are dog people? How many are both? Here's a tree that is showing us a number of things. Night and day. Fall and winter. Male and female. It's harder to see, but here's someone, or at least our traditional understandings of what's male and female. We got country mice and city mice. Gay or straight? The more I'm learning from young people this day, may not necessarily be one or the other. Rich or poor? You get my point, right? We tend to classify things and divide them. There are other ones up there, right? I mean, what ones would you think of, especially that's an Achilles heel for you, the divisions? Oh, Democrat, Republican? Is that a challenge? Okay, let's just say it out loud because it is a challenge. But what about skinny or fat? How about coffee drinker or tea drinker? Come on, there got to be some other ones, right? What's your Achilles heel? Another one. Sorry? Young and old, right? Whatever that means. Sorry? Right to speak your peace? Pepsi and Coke. Pepsi, no Coke, cheeseburger, cheeseburger, Pepsi, no Coke. Yeah, you have to be an old person to know Saturday Night Live. The point is that we tend to see the world as we are, not as how it is. And one of our greatest challenges is that because we have an ability, as I mentioned in the first sermon, to separate out reality with symbol. We're the only animal that we know of for sure that can think about a past, a present, and a future. Most other animals are just living in the present. That's not to say that you can't teach a dog to sit, thank God. But most of the time, that dog has forgotten what the command was when the treat's in front of him. I hope you're enjoying this. Do you see both the strength and the challenge of the ego, of the human being sort of being in charge of everything? What if we had a mutual joint stock world? I love this phrase. This is something that Larry Rasmussen has in his book. The betweenness of life calls for a new way of seeing the world and our place in it. Whether in deep time or shallow, we all live downhill, downwind, and downstream from everybody and everything to date, and uphill, upwind, and upstream from everyone and everything else to follow. How easy it is to forget that. But does that strike you as kind of true and real? What if we shifted from human and non-human to more than human and other than human? Sorry? Yes. What if community went beyond just a human reference to the rest of life, even the cosmos? Getting kind of spooky-mooky on you now, right? And yet the reality is how narrow sometimes our perspective is. What if neighbor was all that participates in being, organic, inorganic, animal, plant? What's the state of the mutual joint stock world on all meridians? How many of you have read Moby Dick? I encourage you to Google Moby Dick and the state of our mutual joint stock world and see what you come up with. This is basically getting at how everything is connected on all, any way you look at it, all meridians. And Larry Rasmussen, like many scientists, thinks that if we continue living the way we've been living, it isn't sustainable. And change won't be easy. And every way of life defends entrenched biases and protected privileges. Can I get a witness on that? So we have to analyze how we take in the world and how power is organized. And how change happens. Boy, this feels like just a little small assignment, doesn't it? Aren't you glad you came this morning? That's part of the problem. When things are so big, we'd rather not pay attention because it's too big. It's somebody else's job, right? Who is that somebody? By the way, I'll throw in, it's a little bit like preparing coffee in the summertime. If you all like coffee, we need somebody to help us, or we ain't going to have no coffee, because it isn't sustainable with two people doing all the work. Can I get a witness on that? Yeah. Carolyn Rundorf is now going to elevate the roof of the church.
The chairs are not all out this morning either. That's a sign.
We'll see what it's a sign of. But it's true, isn't it? I mean, most of the time when something's really big, we want to trim it down to what we can do, and thank God, because at least we have some power to do something in our immediate realm of influence. First work's over. It's a phrase from a book by this man. Very good. How many know who this person is? James Baldwin, yes. He's written a book called The Price of the Ticket. And in it he says, in the church I come from, we were counseled from time to time to do our first works over. Go back to where you started, or as far back as you can, examine all of it, travel your road again, and tell the truth about it. Sing or shout or keep it to yourself, but know whence you came. To do first works, Larry Rasmussen, in relationship to earth-honoring faith, means to re-examine everything from its onset and speak the truth as best we know it. That's an important caveat. As best we know it, because the truth is never captured by one human or one group of humans. I think that's part of our challenge. For an earth-honoring faith to make a difference, to work out our geosocial salvation, note that that's a change from individual salvation. Most of Christianity has devoted itself to individual salvation, which is important, but if we're all a bunch of little individuals that are saved, then we forget about all the other little individual souls and the way in which we are all together, including the soul of the earth. What frames and guides our feelings and our thoughts? Every culture of human history has had a lifestyle that defines how it is we understand everything. I remember first encountering this when I was a little boy, and I went to, in Maine, the Passamaquoddy tribe was one of the Native Americans, and I heard one of a Native American telling a story. It was at a Passamaquoddy days in Eastport. And they were telling their story about how it is that their ancestors used to understand the world in which they lived. And they would talk about Brother Loon and Sister Salmon. And I remember thinking, that's kind of an odd way to think about it. That's because they completely different perspective of how the world is and how we are in relationship to it. So here are some of the illusions of our current situation, our current way of life. The Industrial Revolution began in the late 1700s and went kind of through the middle of the 1800s. And do you know what drove, well, lots of things. There was a primary driver of the Industrial Revolution. Coal. Fossil fuels, indeed. Fossil fuels. And the fossil fuel explosion created a kind of willingness humans could bypass all of the many of the natural rhythms of the world which had governed them. Now, this isn't, I don't want this to come across as all critical, it's just simply real that I didn't even know that, for example, a gallon of gas relies on 3 tons of organic matter. That's a lot. And my brain has trouble with that much scale. How about you? Do you have trouble with scale sometimes about how big something is? So fossil fuels let humans bypass the rhythms and requirements of nature that pre-industrial populations had to observe by necessity. The other illusion is that we could bring the ecosphere under our control. Now, I don't know about you, but how many times do you think New Orleans has flooded? How much money do we invest in fighting wildfires? How many of you have seen beach homes that are sort of hanging by the edge because the beach doesn't want to be there anymore? So yes, we can control it, but we kind of don't necessarily understand that our control has limits, and sometimes the world will come back and kind of push to say, well, no. One of the illusions, and I've mentioned this a couple of times, is about scale. So from 1950 to 2000, the global consumer economy produced, transported, and consumed as many goods and services as throughout the entirety of prior history. Does that not blow your mind? When I saw that, I thought, are you kidding me? Really? Wow! In the past 50 years, more than everything that came before it. Now, there's also been a radical change in terms of how it is that we live in the world. I don't have to carry my water. I don't have to cut trees down and burn them. So there's a lot of ways in which, yes, there has been a tremendous change in the way in which we live, and we are recipients of that. There's no question about that. Do I want to go back to a pre-industrial age? Heck no, I don't. Do I want to be aware of how it is that we find ourselves and maybe why it is we find ourselves? Yeah, I'm invested in that. Whoop. Oh, shoot. Oh, my clicker just went nuts. Tim or Mo, can you pull my... Thank you. Here we go. Modernity is no longer rooted in the earth, but in technology and organization, both of which let us construct a meaningful life without reference to the natural world, much less active care for it. So if you're anything like I am, I have kind of compartmentalized nature. It's an important part of my life. I love being in nature, but I sort of think of it as being separate from a category, if you will, and how we're just integral parts of it. So from 2001 to 2010, it was the hottest decade since record-keeping began. Swings of drought and flooding increasing across the globe. Polar ice caps and the Himalayan glaciers are melting at record rates. Oceans warming. It's also becoming more acidic. It's affecting the biosphere, especially the diversity. And as I said earlier, we're masters of self-deception. When faced with large-scale problems, we question the evidence. And it isn't just about the Earth, is it? I mean, let's be real with ourselves here. Sometimes I find myself just putting aside something if it's too big, like how it is that we're going to get Jacob through private college. You know, it'll happen somehow, but I'm not quite sure how. So I'll just... Any other large-scale issues that we ignore for our sanity? Yeah, homelessness, housing, racial situation in our country, the way we perceive other people. So there's the wisdom of the gospel. Jesus told them this parable. No one tears a piece from a new garment and sews it on an old garment. Otherwise, the new will be torn and the piece from the new won't match the old. No one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins and will be spilled and skins will be destroyed. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins, and no one after drinking old wine desires new wine, because old is better. What a lot in there. Jesus knew that if his expression of the love of God was going to be accepted in the world, it was going to require some new skins, new ways of thinking, new ways of understanding, new ways of being. And so I think an earth-honoring faith realizes that the world's a new place and old strategies aren't likely to fit, and there just might be something good about returning to some old, earlier ways of living, and I have Exhibit A. This is the Randall Bodman House. How many cars do you count in that picture? Three. How many people live at the Randall Bodman House? Three. When I was a kid, I didn't have a car. I had a motorcycle, bicycle, and I would borrow my parents' car. Now, it was an inconvenience for them, and it was an inconvenience for me, but have you noticed when you get to a certain level of privilege, it's awfully difficult to go back? It's really nice that Jacob has the Maggie-mobile to run around with, and we don't have to shuttle him from place to place. And yet, if I'm totally honest with you, this is not good. I'm not modeling for you good earth-honoring faith, because two of those vehicles are gas guzzlers. And here's Exhibit B, the Randall Bodman House. The Randall Bodman House has four bedrooms. In 6 weeks, guess how many Randall Bodmans will be living in the house? Two. Is it not odd and somewhat ridiculous for two people to live in a four-bedroom house? Yeah, you've been listening to my wife. The point is, our whole understanding about what enough is enough has changed. It's changed. Some of it's good. Some of it, it's probably had a cost for other parts of the globe that we don't necessarily see. Or even parts of the globe that are standing out on the street because they don't have a place. And I got 4 bedrooms and 2 of them empty. So I got some homework for you. Think about the assumptions that our life as we see it are built. First one is the good life is one of productive labor and material well-being. When people have more, their freedom of choice is expanded and they can and will be more. Humanity has the right, perhaps even the calling, to use nature's resources for an improvement in its material standard of living. Modern science and technology, coupled with democracy, have helped achieve a superior civilization, first in the West, then for the rest. We don't see the world as it is, we see the world as we are. And if you don't take anything else from the sermon, I hope you'll take that. That we don't necessarily, we see the world from our history, from our culture, from the backgrounds, the people we've met. We don't have a universal perception. That's what causes macro troubles. So think about those assumptions, whether they fit, whether they don't fit, and how it is that you see the world as you are rather than as it is. That's my homework for you, and I hope to see you next week. And may God continue to bless the work that we have, the blessings that we have. May we hold in tension the treasures and the gifts and the blessings that God has given us with the responsibility of being awake in the world to the human community and the eco community. And the people were heard to say, Amen.